3310 has been a busy year. We started it in the middle of an alien invasion, with the bubble occupied by 8 seemingly impregnable Titan motherships. By the end of the year, we'd not only defeated that invasion, we'd also gained 4 new ships, a faster frameshift drive, and a completely new political system. This is the Galnet News Digest review of the year 3310.
It is believed that the Thargoids invaded the human-occupied bubble as a direct result of attempts by Azimuth Biotech and its leader Caleb Wycherley, the man also known as Salvation, to eliminate them completely using the Proteus Wave weapon, a weapon that used technology from another alien species, the Guardians, a species that millions of years ago had wiped itself out while trying to eliminate the Thargoids. The Proteus Wave was fired in August 3308. It was a spectacular failure, with the Thargoids seemingly well prepared to counteract the Guardian technology used by Azimuth. They attacked and destroyed Wycherley and thousands of his followers in the HIP-22460 system. And then they called in reinforcements from far away. The intercepted reply from deep space was reported to be, "We see them. We are coming." 8 bright stars, known colloquially as Stargoids, were seen heading towards us. And in November 3308, when they arrived, we discovered that those stars were huge Thargoid motherships, bringing fleets of Thargoid ships. The Thargoids seemed intent on wiping us out, possibly believing us to be a resurgence of the Guardians that they'd fought millions of years earlier. The Thargoids rapidly took control of systems surrounding the 8 Titans and started expanding into more adjacent systems. Millions of human inhabitants were displaced or went missing. For the first year of the invasion, from November 3308 all the way through 3309, we learned to fight back against Thargoid expansion and to start winning back systems from Thargoid control. We had no way of striking back against the 8 Titans themselves, but we had gradually developed technology to get us through the caustic cloud to see our enemy close up. Caustic sink launchers protected us from the corrosive atmosphere surrounding the Titans, and the Thargoid pulse neutralizer allowed us to pass through the Titans' electromagnetic repulsion field. The Pulse Wave Xeno scanner allowed us to gather samples from the surface of the Titans and also provided an explanation for the tens of thousands of people missing from systems the Thargoids had invaded. They were being kept as prisoners in pods in subsurface storage chambers inside the Titans. Subsurface extraction missiles, first available in October 3309, helped us begin to rescue these hostages, leading to the still unresolved problem about what to do with them. Right at the end of 3309, we had one of the Titans, Tyrannus, surrounded, with only a few systems left under its control, and both of its spire sites, organic industrial mining sites that supplied resources to the Titan, poisoned using a mechanism provided by Professor Palin. So, we had the firepower and the forces willing to contain the invasion, but we lacked the technology to destroy the Titans themselves. Did we have any justification in hoping that the war could be over by the end of the following year, 3310?
At the very beginning of 3310, it was Guardian Technology Specialist Ram Tarr who led the initiative to find a way to inflict damage on the Thargoid motherships. We needed a new weapon. We also had a problem using Guardian weapons in general to attack a Titan. Guardian technology was useless because the Thargoids deployed countermeasures, an anti-Guardian field that rapidly destroyed the weapons. So, we needed a double-pronged approach. Ram Tarr was convinced that if Guardian weapons could be used, he would find a way to make the Titan vulnerable. The first breakthrough, in February 3310, was the discovery of micromolecules called nanites that could disrupt Thargoid biotechnology. Simultaneously, Professor Palin used samples brought back from Thargoid spire sites to ensure the nanite technology could be made immune from the Thargoid's anti-guardian field. When delivered into the ring of 8 thermal vents on the upper surface of the Titan, using a nanite torpedo launcher, this new warhead was capable of temporarily shutting down the Titan's heat management systems, forcing it to expose its thermal core as a form of emergency heat management. That core was susceptible to damage far more than the armoured exterior of the Titan. With the nanite launcher released to pilots, we had everything we needed. It took only a few days of hitting Tyrannus with nanite torpedoes and anti-Zeno missiles to damage the alien thermal core beyond repair. On the 1st of March, the core was destroyed, leading to the Titan entering meltdown. Thousands of Thargoid vessels fled as rescuers scrambled to save as many of the human hostages as they could. Exactly 24 hours later, on the 2nd of March, the first of the 8 Titans, Titan Tyrannus, exploded. A spectacular sight that gave us hope that the Thargoid War really could be won. Within a couple of weeks, the wreckage of Titan Tyrannus was being investigated. They didn't announce it at the time, but a team of engineers from Achilles Aerospace was paying particularly close interest to what could be found. It seemed likely that there'd be technologies we could make use of, if only we knew what to look for. Simultaneously, and very shortly after Tyrannus, Titan Ligong was efficiently wiped out. We were getting good at it. In April, Ramtar managed to extend field resistance to all Guardian weapons, making it possible to take shard cannon into the Maelstrom for the first time, at least for those pilots capable of gathering the required materials. The modification initially required hard-to-obtain tactical core chips that could only be salvaged from revenants and banshees at spire sites and occupied settlements. With many pilots using nanite torpedoes and shard cannon, Titan Oya was dispatched swiftly. And at the end of May, just after the introduction of the Supercruise Overcharge Frameshift Drive, the elimination of Titan Hadad meant that half of the Titans, the relatively easy half, had been destroyed in just 3 months.
During the course of the war, there was quite a bit of technology developed to combat the Titans, in addition to the standard and enhanced ranges of anti-Zeno weapons. They were almost all derived from existing technology. The names chosen for them were not necessarily obvious. Here's a recap of the modules that were developed, where they came from, and the names they were given. To get through the caustic clouds surrounding the Titans, an efficient way of managing caustic damage was needed. Rather than develop a better limpet, the solution was to develop a variant of the heatsink launcher, the caustic sink launcher, which stores up caustic damage and spits it out at intervals. In order to get through the Titan's pulse, a variant of the shutdown field neutralizer was developed. The shutdown field neutralizer protects against Thargoid interceptors, and the device that works against Titans was called the Thargoid Pulse Neutralizer, leading to some confusion about which device was needed for each purpose. Guardian weapons and modules were protected by a completely new modification, anti-Guardian zone resistance, which sounds like it's against the Guardians, but actually resisting the Thargoid field that is anti-Guardian. There's a double negative in the name. In order to find parts of the Titan that can be scavenged for materials, or indeed for captive human hostages, Aegis chose not to develop an enhancement to the Xenoscanner, nor even the enhanced Xenoscanner, but instead they turned to mining technology. A modified version of the Pulse Wave Analyzer was created. The Pulse Wave Xenoscanner, once again omitting the word Titan in the name, was specifically designed to examine Thargoid Titans for things that could be blasted or abraded off the surface, and also to find those concealed human hostages. How could the humans be extracted from their subsurface places of confinement? Once again, mining technology provided the answer. The rather terrifying solution was to use a variant of the subsurface displacement missile, which is designed to drill down into an asteroid and when it reaches a rich seam of ore, to be detonated, thus releasing the concealed minerals. This new missile, the subsurface extraction missile, was adapted to drill down into the Titan's subsurface storage chambers, rather than an asteroid, and to detonate in a gentle, non-harmful way, releasing the grateful hostages to be cargo scooped by the rescuer or by hovering Thargoid scythes. After all that lot, the nanite torpedo pylon is much more straightforward. You take a normal torpedo pylon, fit a nanite warhead, which has been treated with anti-guardian zone resistance, and there you have it.
Not everything developed using alien technology was for fighting Thargoids. The biggest technological development of the year was the overcharged supercruise frameshift drive, and it was developed by a group of engineers from Achilles, the robotics corporation. These engineers took a close interest in what had been recovered from the wreckage of the Titans, in particular, Titan drive components. Their reasoning ran thus. The Titans, when travelling as Stargoids between systems, travel at incredibly fast speeds, many thousands of times faster than the speed of light, without making any hyperspace jumps. The Stargoids are also capable of changing speed and direction almost instantly, even when really close to a star. The existing Sirius frameshift drive is nowhere as good as the Stargoids. It's capable of supercruising at up to 2001 times the speed of light, but it's heavily restricted by gravity wells and can take up to 30 minutes to get up to the top speed. Sirius is a big corporation, and Achilles Aerospace needed something pretty special to get noticed in the frameshift drive market. Adding the supercruise speed of a Thargoid Titan to existing frameshift drive technology would get Achilles Aerospace noticed. Armed with this reasoning, Achilles plugged a Titan drive component into a frameshift drive and were surprised and delighted to find that they'd created the very first supercruise overcharged frameshift drive. By pressing the boost button when in supercruise, they were catapulted into a chaotic state where the ship bucked and twisted, burned fuel at an astonishing rate and rapidly overheated. But it was fast, very fast, and it was completely immune to being slowed down by gravity wells. The initial version of the Achilles FSD, released in April, had a lower hyperspace jump range than the market-leading Sirius drives and was therefore of limited use. But Achilles really wanted to make this thing a success. They worked with ship manufacturer Falcon de Lacy to refine the new drive. In early May, they were able to release a full range of drives that, when fully engineered, offered a better jump range than the very best Sirius drive. There was no longer any need to make a choice. After a 10-year monopoly, Sirius frameshift drives, inferior in every way to the new Achilles drives, were about to become obsolete. And the massive time barrier that often made travelling around in systems impractical or at best tedious was eliminated. But that's not all the collaboration with ship manufacturers gave us.
De Lacy could see the problems with the Achilles supercruise overcharge technology. They could see that the existing ship designs could never deliver the benefits of fast in-system travel and also deliver the stability, fuel economy and heat management that pilots demanded. Working in collaboration with Achilles, De Lacy developed the first built-for-SCO ship, the Python Mark II, released in May. This new ship is a combat-focused variant of the general-purpose Python, with an extra-large hardpoint and 6 utility mounts instead of 4, combined with better agility, speed, hull and shield strength. The compromises were a smaller power plant and distributor and significantly fewer large internal compartments, so it needs to be outfitted with some skill to get the desired performance. The Python Mark II is entirely unsuitable as a cargo vessel, so it's fortunate that Lacon wanted a piece of the SCO action too. Their distinctive forklift-style Type 8 is a medium ship with a maximum hauling capacity not much less than the Anaconda. While the Type 9 and the Imperial Cutter remain the ships with the largest capacity, the Type 8 offers a good jump range, excellent stability in supercruise overcharge, and the ability to exploit markets in outposts and settlements that larger ships can't access. Despite being a freighter, it has the hard points to fight back while it makes its escape. By releasing the Type 8, Lacon has made its old Type 7 transporter completely pointless, as the Type 8 can do everything the Type 7 can do, and a whole lot more. The third built-for-SCO ship released this year is the Zorgon Peterson Mandalay. Zorgon's stable of ships has been the most idiosyncratic of all the ship manufacturers, comprising the diminutive hauler, the excellent but now rather dated combat ship Ferda Lance, and the niche racer and combat ship the Mamba, which, like the FDL, sports a huge hardpoint. Zorgon's huge Panamax cargo ship, the Panther Clipper, was never released, following an argument about whether it could safely get through the toast rack. So, their SCO-enhanced exploration ship, the Mandalay, came as a welcome surprise as the most desirable ship to own. It has the longest jump range of any ship, making it possible to go exploring the outer reaches of the galaxy without having to use an Anaconda oil tanker. While it doesn't have the fastest SCO performance, it features excellent stability, heat management and fuel efficiency, so it's no longer an effort to travel across a system to map that Earth-like world you've just discovered, orbiting the second star 450,000 light seconds away. It also features four medium hardpoints, so you can defend those precious first discoveries you're carrying back to Universal Cartographics. Finally, for new ships, Falcon de Lacy has released a true general-purpose successor to the Cobra Mark III and the limited-availability Cobra Mark IV. The unsurprisingly named Cobra Mark V is better in every way than the two previous Cobra models. Lighter, faster, stronger, with a better jump range and the ability to carry up to 110 tons in the cargo hold. A truly amazing achievement for a small ship. Like the Cobra Mark IV, it has five hardpoints, but it has three medium and two small, compared to the Mark IV's three small and two medium. And in supercruise overcharge, it is fast. Really fast. A properly equipped Cobra Mark V can do the hut and run in less than 18 minutes.
The four new SCO-optimised ships pioneered something new for the galaxy. They were all initially made available to early adopters for ARCs instead of credits. Each ship comes in two versions, a basic model, ready to configure, and a stellar version that includes a reasonable A-rated loadout. This option has high upfront costs, but a zero rebuy, which can be useful if you expect to die frequently. If you're happy with the stellar loadout as it comes, you can effectively transfer it instantly and for free to wherever you are in the galaxy by selling it remotely and redeploying it at the local shipyard. The stellar version also comes with a paint job and a sometimes goofy-looking ship kit. Thankfully, all the ships also became, or will become, available for credits after 3 months. A small selection of other pre-built ships is also made available for ARCs. These builds are designed to get new pilots up and running quickly and are not always the optimal build for each task. The pre-configured ships made available for sale are the Diamondback Exploration Jumpstart, the Type 6 Laser Mining Jumpstart, the Alliance Chieftain AX Combat Jumpstart, the Beluga Liner Luxury Transport Jumpstart, and the Vulture Bounty Hunter Jumpstart. The cost of paint jobs and ship kits was hiked significantly, causing some disgruntlement amongst pilots, especially those who had a large number of ARCs in the bank and the value of which was dramatically devalued overnight. But at least the chrome and gold paint jobs became available again after several years' absence, so that's something. There was a major shake-up in engineering in August. The engineers decided that instead of the old process of giving you a completely random amount of modification in return for your offering of hard-won materials, they would now guarantee that if you had level 5 reputation with the engineer, any module could be fully engineered from nothing in exactly 15 steps. If you hadn't built up a reputation with the engineer, it might take a few more rolls, but it would no longer be random. To accompany this change, manufactured materials suddenly became plentiful. Visiting a single high-grade emission signal source would fill up one of your grade 5 materials completely, with some left over. These signal sources are common in systems in certain faction states, such as Boom, and material traders make it easy to trade these materials for others, so no one would ever need to be short of manufactured materials for engineering again. Bizarrely, encoded emissions signal sources remained parsimonious, giving out very few encoded materials, so the best bet continues to be visiting poor Commander Jameson's crash site in HIP 12099 and scanning all the uplinks there. There are mysteriously more scannable objects than there used to be. Commander Jameson gets an awful lot of visitors, but not many of them are there to commemorate his sacrifice 150 years ago. As for raw materials, there are some crashed anacondas with more raw materials than before, but travelling around geological features in your SRV shooting anything that moves is probably still the best way. If you want to get your materials quicker and don't mind leaving the bubble, the crystal shard forests on the planets around HIP 36601C or any of the rain tree forests in Guardian space contain a silly amount of grade 4 raw materials. Flak launchers and collector limpets mean you don't even need to land. Even better, just shooting Thargoids in controlled systems would earn small drops of material as a reward when each system was eventually cleared. This is no longer available, but something similar became a feature of the new political system, Power Play 2.0. There's one loose end that hasn't yet been explained. On the 16th of October, the Xenological Science Symposium declared that following the exciting discovery of the technology that made the SCO drive possible, there are likely to be other technological developments based on what could be scavenged from the Titans. Professor Seamus Madigan particularly mentioned enhancements in heat management. Nothing has come of that yet, unless he was referring to the cool-running SCO drive of the Mandalay. It seems likely that some other development in ship technology is just around the corner.
Let's get back to the Thargoid War. By the end of May, with half the Titans destroyed, the Thargoids were losing ground quickly. Could they find a way to turn this around? They tried, but it didn't work as well as they might have hoped. In early July, the Thargoids changed their strategy, becoming less expansionist and attacking only occupied systems. This may have been a fateful mistake as it reduced the breadth of the support base for each Titan, making them easier to isolate. Indra was defeated in July, followed by Thor in August. It was on 19th of September, exactly a week after Aidan Tanner had warned of potential counterattacks, that the Thargoids launched the first of the two surprise attacks that brought an end to the invasion. They attacked Shinrata Desra, home of the Pilots' Federation, with great force, shutting down most facilities at Jameson Memorial and Engineer Laurie Jameson's base. This struck deep. Many commanders rely on Jameson Memorial to buy and equip their ships. Fortunately, it was a short-lived attack, with support from the rescue ship Cornwallis, which relocated to nearby V-886 Centauri, along with one megaship each from the Sirius Corporation and Azimuth Biotech. The Thargoids were driven out in 4 days, a dramatic demonstration of the Thargoids' weakening grip on the war. In retrospect, the attack on Shinrata might have been a rehearsal for what was to come in December. There were now two Titans left, Raijin and Kokijo. Because they had many more systems under their control, it was inevitable that these final Titans would take much longer to destroy. Raijin was eventually isolated and destroyed in mid-October, and it was on the day of its destruction that events took an unexpected turn. News was leaked of a medical emergency concerning Sojin A, the Thargoid Whisperer.
From humble beginnings and entirely against her will, Sojin A has become one of the key players in the Thargoid War. Used as a test subject in Salvation's brutal experiments in the early 3300s, her brain was implanted with a device that was intended to help her control a Thargoid scout spaceship. Azimuth had not intended her to live, but she escaped, possibly to Colonia, on a courier's ship, and she remained in hiding for 5 years before revealing herself to Aegis, not long after the Proteus Wave incident. So, still had her brain implant, and Aegis doctors concluded that it could not be removed without killing her. It was in any case of interest to them, because it gave So a permanent connection to the Thargoid's hive mind. Unable to completely understand the communications, she was nonetheless able to feel their thoughts. This helped Aegis anticipate the Thargoid's plans. They were soon to find that such a connection could work both ways. On the 18th of October, Sojin A suffered a violent seizure and fell unconscious. Aegis doctors noticed very high levels of brain activity in the unconscious So. Azimuth CEO Torben Rademacher declared So a danger to humanity and demanded the termination of her link to the Thargoids by any means necessary. He was well aware that removal of the Azimuth-fitted brain implant would be fatal. Aegis ignored his demands and took care of So while she slept. When she regained consciousness nearly a week later, she had urgent information which she released to the press as soon as she could, without seeking approval from Aegis. She confirmed what many had feared, that the Thargoids had noticed her presence in their hive mind, and had entered her mind to find out what they could about her. It appears that they tried to control her body like a puppet, but failed, leaving her unconscious. But she was convinced that they probed her memories and in doing so learned about humanity and its origins. This may have been the point when the Thargoids realised we were not Guardians, but it also meant that they knew of our home planet. Meanwhile, efforts to win back the systems controlled by Titan Kukijo, a far greater number than the other Titans, was progressing well. By the 28th of November, Kukijo had just 26 control systems remaining, with at least half of them likely to be lost the following week. It was clear that for the Thargoids, the war was lost. And that's when they made their second and final surprise attack. Titan Kukijo unexpectedly left the system it was in, travelling as a Stargoid towards the very heart of the bubble, to the cradle of humanity, to Sol and planet Earth.
It took a week for Titan Kukijo to travel to Sol. Before it gets there, we need to go back to the end of October, because something momentous had happened to galactic politics. We'd been waiting a year for President-elect Winters to finally take up her role as federal president. President Hudson would retire and Jerome Archer would become leader of the Republican Party and shadow president. We'd also heard growing rumours that Councillor Nakato Kane was gaining a strong following and hoped to be able to challenge the Prime Minister in the alliance. Both of these strands came to a head at the very end of October, when the new political system, known as Power Play 2.0, rolled out. This system established 12 galactic leaders, 4 independents, 4 from the Empire, and 2 each from Federation and Alliance. These 12 powers would battle for territory and, usefully for commanders, would offer significant benefits to anyone who signed up to help them, including care packages of materials and credits, discounts, and earning multipliers for certain activities such as mining and exploration. Participation as a pawn in the power play game of galactic chess would also provide progressive access to power play modules, including prismatic shields, backhound missiles, and the so-called Grom Bomb containment missiles. All powers would offer these modules, so you no longer had to pledge to Princess Ashling just because you wanted prismatic shields. The non-binding commitment each week is to complete 5 missions, which might be transportation, trading rare goods, hacking, collecting wreckage or fighting off ships belonging to enemy powers. Completing these missions earn merits, which in turn earn rewards as each pilot ranks up in the power. There's much more engagement in the process than in the earlier version of Power Play, but we'll need to wait and see how the influence of galactic powers wax and wane in the coming months. If nothing else, you get a nice decal for your ship showing your Power Play rank, and for a small cost, You can choose to fly a pennant, supporting your power.
Stargoid Kokiju flew through several systems on its way to Sol, but there was never any real doubt where it was going. There was panic in Sol and surrounding systems as the alien spacecraft swept through star system after star system. The federal government packed up and moved to Eta Cassiopeia, and there was a huge demand for evacuation flights from those who didn't have the 32,000 credits to buy their own Sidewinder. The evacuation was a hopeless task. Out of a population of 18 billion, fewer than 2 billion could be evacuated in the week before the Titan arrived, so there was a huge civilian population remaining. We had no idea what to expect. A Titan had never directly invaded a populated system, let alone such an important one. Humanity, and the Federation in particular, held its breath. Early on Thursday the 5th of December, the Titan arrived. It took up station around Earth, as its minions wrought havoc in Sol and the surrounding systems. Besides Sol, four other systems, Alpha Centauri, Barnard Star, MOVE 359, and WISE 1506 plus 7027, were taken over by the Thargoids, while another 12 were invaded. Taken off guard, a number of Farragut battlecruisers were destroyed, along with 7 of the 9 rescue megaships that had relocated close to Sol to assist in the battle. The Huttner and the Cornwallis were undamaged and remained operational, while the Allied Solis and the Imperial Sanctum did not take part in the operation. If the Thargoids could consolidate the four control systems and win the battles to complete the invasion of the other 12, then we would be in for a long fight. But humanity rallied round magnificently, with far greater focus than at any time during the 2 years of the war. Previously, it was provincial star systems affected, and life in the heart of the bubble was largely unaffected. The invasion of the Sol system, and a clear and immediate threat to Earth itself, had pilots who'd never had any involvement with the Thargoid invasion, traders, miners, explorers, kitting their ships out to fight off the Thargoids. Following guidance from experienced anti-Xeno pilots, they first headed off the attempted invasions, with systems like Procyon, Tau Ceti, and Sirius freed from threat. Progress was faster than anyone could have hoped. After 5 days, all 12 invasion systems had been cleared, and there was enough time to eliminate the Thargoids from the four controlled systems as well, with Alpha Centauri the last system cleared just under a week after the dramatic redeployment of the Titan into Sol. With no systems left under its control and no supplies arriving, Titan Kokiju became vulnerable to direct attack. It was time to take the battle to Sol and to the Titan. A few of the starports in Sol had battled on through the first week, but by this time only one, Mars High, was still operational. AX pilots based themselves there and at the rescue megaship Huttner in Leuton's Star. The task, as with other Titans, was to repeatedly cause it to overheat using nanite torpedoes and then to do as much damage as possible to its thermal core. And slowly but surely we did it. At 6:45 a.m. on Tuesday the 17th of December, the final ring of the thermal core fell dark and the Titan entered meltdown. Commanders rushed to rescue as many hostages as possible from the stricken mothership. Exactly 24 hours later, as with all the other Titans, this final Titan exploded spectacularly, bringing to an end more than 2 years of war. The Thargoids fled back to wherever they'd come from, leaving damaged stations, a caustic cloud, and a debris field orbiting Earth.
It wasn't the end of the work, but it was the end of what is now known as the Second Thargoid War. Operation Ida and others worked tirelessly to repair the damaged stations and bring Sol back to something approaching its former state. On 26th of December, they were all once again operational. Commanders who participated in the battle for Sol were rewarded with pre-engineered SCO frameshift drives that were even better than the off-the-shelf drives offered by Achilles. A stripped-down Mandalay, fitted with one of these drives, can jump very nearly 100 light-years. These pre-engineered drives are also available to purchase from human technology brokers, but you'll need to provide materials, including Titan drive components, for each drive you want to buy, which can, if you're patient enough, be collected from the wreckage of any of the eight Titans. In the debris field, there are still pods containing captive humans. These can be salvaged and turned into any search and rescue contact. In the Alliance, those who have been rescued are rehabilitated and allowed to resume their previous lives. In the Federation and Empire, they're still being kept in protective detention at secure medical facilities. Some of them have been kept there for more than a year. There were rumours that these people might have been reprogrammed by the Thargoids as sleeper agents, but there is no evidence to bear this out. The fear that they might turn into a zombie army seems rather fantastical now the Thargoid threat has receded. Surgeon A remains under the care of Aegis, still connected by her brain implant to the Thargoid hive mind. She believes that Salvation, the person who started the war, may not have died when the Thargoids attacked and destroyed the Bright Sentinel megaship following the Proteus Wave incident in August 3308. Despite the identification of his lifeless body, she believes he lives on as a disembodied consciousness in some sort of Guardian-inspired neural network. There is, as yet, no evidence about whether or not this might be true. The caustic cloud above Earth is rapidly dissipating, but the wreckage will remain there as a memorial to the war. A beacon has been placed near it, commemorating those who died in the 2 long years of fighting. Following the displacement of so many citizens from the core systems, there is now talk of a more relaxed approach to the colonisation of new systems, systems untainted by a history of Thargoid warfare. A programme is planned to start early in the new year. There's one more odd thing. The wreckage of all eight Titans contains a spectrographic image that appears to be the eight Thargoid Titans in their Stargoid form, swirling towards a group of 14 human figures. Does this mean that the Thargoids have realised that humanity is separate from their ancient foe, the Guardians? We've fought them once before, a war 150 years ago that ended in the Thargoids' defeat following a daring biochemical attack by Commander John Jameson, the hero who is now more famous for the encoded data drops at the site of his crashed Cobra. Will the Thargoids, once they have the time to regroup, choose to attack us again? Will we learn to take the war to the Thargoids' homeworld? Or is this era of conflict over? Will we have peace in our time? We have reached the end of an era. With the modern frameshift drive a little over 10 years old, with the Thargoids successfully repelled after a 2-year-long conflict, it is time to look to the future. If not with confidence, then with hope.